The American Homebrewers Association has a special offer for new and renewing members. Join or renew by the end of September with offer code JOINIPA, that's J-O-I-N-I-P-A, all one word, and you'll receive a free copy of Mitch Steele's classic book, IPA. Go to homebrewersassociation.org and use the offer code JOINIPA. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 27th, 2018. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, homebrewer Caleb Buck shares some delicious, spontaneously fermented sours and talks about his experiment looking at measured IBUs in these beers that have used aged hops. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you'd do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, that'll help new listeners to find us, they say. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. This Friday, don't forget to look for our Basic Brewing video episode where we taste the beer that I brewed with that Lithuanian farmhouse yeast that I got from listener Frederick in Denmark. It is a beer that I want to try to replicate in the future. It's very tasty. My wife Susan and I bottled another beer that I don't know if I'll ever want to replicate. It's my Booberry Tart beer made with Monster Cereal Booberry. It is a weird one. Will it be good? I'm actually not sure yet. Fingers crossed on that one. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Russell from Jonesboro, Tennessee writes, I'd like to know how you measure out the 3 grams of yeast for the hop sampler batches. Do you use a sterilized measuring spoon or do it by weight or just guess? Thanks for the question, Russell. I use a scale that's accurate to the 100th of a gram. It's called the Blade Scale, and it's by American Way Scales. And I believe it's designed to be used by jewelers and maybe drug dealers, for all I know. It also weighs in ounces, you know, fractions of ounces, and carats as well. So you can find them for around $10 online. They're pretty cheap. I just take a clean piece of aluminum foil right off the roll and pour the dry yeast onto that. And then I use the foil to actually pour the yeast into the fermenter jug. So that little scale is also great for measuring hops, too, for small batches when you just want a few grams, you know, say, of a high alpha hop. And speaking of our hop samplers, I also brewed a 5-gallon batch of the recipe that I use for our hop sampler batches. I put 6 pounds of dry malt extract into 5 gallons of water, brought it up just to the boil, and then added 3.5 ounces of hops that, you know, various hops that we liked in the hop sampler series. And then with the heat off, I just let the wort sit there for 30 minutes for a hop stand. And I pitched with Imperial Juice yeast. And the airlock smells great. And I have high hopes for that one. Super easy to brew. And, of course, I brewed that beer in my electric brew-in-a-bag system from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. But this week, I don't want to talk about their great electric systems with their Warthog controllers. I got an email from High Gravity announcing limited edition wine kits from Wine Expert. And High Gravity says, due to the popularity of these varieties and restricted availability, sales of the kits must be made on a reservation basis. And we're talking Wine Expert Black Cabernet, Fumé Blanc, Corazon, Symphony Gewürztraminer, and Barbaresco. The deadline for the limited edition wines is Thursday, November 29th at 5 p.m. It sounds like a long way away, but it'll be here before you know it. You can place your order on the phone or by ordering the kits from highgravitybrew.com. All the details are available on the offer on the site as well. These wines sound delicious, and High Gravity won't be ordering any extra, so if you're interested, check them out now. And while you are on highgravitybrew.com, you can always drool over their excellent selection of electric brewing systems from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels, all with the excellent Warthog controllers. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric brewing purchase, all at family-owned and operated. HighGravityBrew.com. Okay, let's head to the brew shop of Steve Wilkes to talk to Caleb Buck about his delicious sour beers and his experiment looking at their IBUs. Well, here we are in the back of Steve's brew shop in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Steve Wilkes, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, James, and thanks for coming out to my shop today.
Yeah, well, we should thank our guest, our special guest today, Caleb Buck.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. This is, we've been talking about getting together since like April, and here it is September. So this is like a fine beer or a fine wine. This is well aged. The preparations for this. So, what is your specialty? You live up in Missouri, a little ways from us. What do you play with? What is your specialty?
Yeah, so I'm a home brewer. I have been a home brewer since roughly 2012, beginning of 2012. It was actually my first semester down here at University of Arkansas.
Gogs.
Yes, with Pig Suey. I primarily focus on wild sour and funky stuff. That's what really, you know, interests me. You know, I started out doing the typical IPAs and then making things with crazy fruits and making big beers, and then I just kind of got interested in more beers with a little more finesse, and then I found the Belgian beers, and then I have, within, you know, less than a year of being introduced to Belgians, I was on a plane and we were in Belgium for 15 days, so that was a pretty cool experience. We got to visit some very neat breweries. And it kind of influenced me in the direction that I have gone with my brewing since then, focusing very heavily on spontaneous fermentation, 100% spontaneous fermentation. And then what I would call my sour beers, I use a Solera approach that a lot of guys, you know, use now.
And Solera is where you have a large vessel, and you take some of the beer and add some fresh beer into it and kind of do a blending as you go along, right?
Correct, yeah. I think the beer world is kind of misusing the term. But for the way the beer world uses it, that's how we describe it. I think it is a sherry term?
Yes, it's sherry term, yeah.
So I, in my Solera, I'm going to call it a program. I have, I do a lot like what the Rare Barrel does with their base beers. They have a gold beer, a red beer, and then I don't know if they call theirs a dark or a black. I call mine a black. So I have three vessels that are golden sours that sometimes I treat them slightly differently with different amounts of oak. But I can taste from the three, decide what my blend should be based on what I want to do with it. If I want to add fruit, I might shoot for a blend that is a little less sour because I know the acids from the fruit will contribute to the perceived acidity of the final beer. If I want it to, you know, just blend it and then nothing, you know, bizarre, no adjuncts added to it, I may allow some more acids to be in that base beer. But I've got three just standard. I've got 5 gallon carboys. I've got glass carboys, mm-hmm. and I've got a 6.5. So anywhere in that range is what I've been using for my Solera stuff. I have tried for the first time a PET carboy. Mm. I spoke with Dan Pixley, who is from Milk the Funk fame. Mm. He was speaking at something I was at, and he was saying he used plastic. So I tried it for the first time. I've had it in plastic for probably close to 18 months, and it's very little difference from the glass so far. Mm. So I tiptoed into that one.
I was just going to say, I don't blame you for tiptoeing, but I agree with you. I think there's modern plastics that are sold as carboys. I don't find any problem with those at all.
Yeah. And Steve won't like it when I say that I actually have been fermenting in hardware store water bottles, you know, the 3-gallon water bottles. That
no, I think that's cool too, actually.
I buy everything else from Steve, though.
I think a lot of why the plastic has worked for me so far is I don't sample extremely frequently. Mm. In my Solera program, you know, I'm pretty much committing to not touching it for at least 6 months. So I will primary in not my Solera vessel so that I'm not stacking my trub up deeper and deeper with every fill. I did that the first time, and you know, other people on the internet will say the same thing, but so I primary separately, and then when it's slowed down, then I will pull all the beers out of the Soleras that I have deemed ready to be pulled out and blended into whatever they're going to be turned into. Then I'll fill back up, and then I'm not checking it, you know, weekly, monthly. It's quarterly, usually every 6 months, if not longer. I've got so many going now, it's it's not a problem. And I've got two small children, so they keep me distracted.
And it seems to me that if you're going to do sour beer successfully, it's best not to put all your eggs in one basket, you know, with like one fermenter of a sour beer, because, you know, if it goes bad or it goes in a way that you don't like, then you're stuck. But if you've got other vessels going at the same time that you can blend in together and kind of have something that's more balanced, then you've got kind of a safety net.
Sure, yeah. Not that I would say I have been successful in my mind yet, but I have been brewing sours intentionally for over 4 years now. It's a learning process. I mean, when something takes, you know, I'm not packaging anything that's younger than a year old, pretty much. So I want to see and learn how it develops, you know, over time. So the learning curve is slow. You know, you can read as many books as you want. Books are a great resource. You know, they've really inspired me. But you kind of, for me anyways, the learning is a lot more doing and experiencing yourself. Like some of the stuff that I touch on my blog, you know, it's, you can read the same thing in a book, but for me, the personal side of experiencing it is more meaningful to my learning as a brewer.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm getting thirsty.
I was going to say, I'd like to personally experience some beer.
Yeah.
Good segue.
Yeah.
Are you going to do the honors here? Steve's going to do the honors.
Well, sure.
What have we got going on here, Caleb?
So the first beer we're going to taste is a beer that I call 3-in-1. This is my
oily beer.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't even thought of that. This is my version of what a blended, you know, like lambic style beer would be. So I'm not trying to necessarily create lambic, but that's the inspiration for this. I adhere to, you know, what is traditionally held as, you know, the authentic lambic process as closely as I can, with the exception of I do choose to use locally grown triticale instead of wheat.
Huh.
I as a source of, you know, something local to this. So this is not trying to, you know, exactly, you know, clone lambic. It's that process, I think, is beautiful. The people that make those beers are, I mean, speaking specifically about Cantillon, because I've been there and I've met them, they were very kind, very humble. Their facility is just extremely neat, if you've not been. And it just really inspired me to just try and figure out how to do something like that where I live with my local microflora captured via cool ship, and trying to get some local ingredients in there. I now have my own aged hops that I have grown myself that I can start introducing. I've not done that yet. But trying to create something in that vein that is inspired by guys like Cantillon and Drefontaine and such.
I was going to use Quadra Triticale, but the tribbles got to it. So
I think that was a beer from Stone, correct?
Was it?
I think they did one called Quadra Triticale. Yeah, that's a Star Trek reference,
oh, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's the trouble with tribbles. Cheers, guys, by the way, with our plastic cups.
Yeah.
Clink.
Cheers.
Clunk.
So,
talk about this beer.
Sure. Yeah. So this is a blend of 1, 2, and 3-year-old 100% spontaneous beers. Would you like the recipe?
Sure.
Let me pull.
Or at least the highlights.
Yeah. So
and you do have do you have the recipe on your blog?
Yeah, the blog details it pretty thoroughly.
So what's your URL?
So if you just, it's archaicpursuit.com, so archaic SUIT. So archaicpursuit.com. That'll get you there.
So give us the highlights of the recipe.
Sure. It's roughly 35% of a wheat type grain, so unmalted raw grain. I use triticale. It's traditional to use raw wheat. And then the remainder being a pilsen of your choice. I use Belgian pilsen. The beer that's inspired is from Belgium. So that's what I use. Then it is turbid mashed, which is a way of creating a very highly starchy wort. So you mash with multiple steps. You pull runnings off, thin runnings, the runnings themselves, no grains. It's somewhat like a decoction, except you're taking the thin portion aside and you're denaturing it as quickly as possible so that you don't convert those starches to sugars. So roughly, based on the numbers that I've heard the authentic lambic guys reciting, stop roughly around 118, pull off, I think, if I'm doing a double batch, which for me is about 12 gallons, I'll usually pull off about a half a gallon. And it looks like slightly tan milk. Huh. I mean, it is very milky looking a lot of times. It depends on how thin you do it. So it's very thick at that point. You do a very thick mash, pull off the turbid portion, and then traditionally I believe you add boiling water back or very hot water back to get your mash steps up. I now have a Herm system where I can kind of manipulate it with recirculation so I don't have to dump the extremely hot water in there. But you raise it up a couple different times. You pull off some turbid wort a couple different times. I think on mine I usually do two pulls. Usually about a half of a gallon that is very, very milky. Then I add some more water back, raise the temperature up, let it sit a little while. It's in the 130s Fahrenheit. And then I usually pull about 2 gallons off that's a little less milky, and then set it aside. And when I'm setting it aside, you're bringing it up to near boiling so that you are killing all the enzymes, denaturing them, so that it doesn't convert. And then at that point, then it's mostly a standard mash. You're going to the standard alpha beta rests, trying to convert what is left. At the end of the mash, you go to mash out. You return your turbid portion, which you have set aside and have heated up, 190, 200 near boiling. You return that to the mash bed and filter it through with the rest of the wort. So the idea is this super long drown out. It usually takes me 3 to 4 hours for the mash. I've gotten, I would say, fairly good at it. It takes me about 3 hours. I've actually done it a couple times with a child strapped to me, so it's not so hard that you can't do it while babysitting.
Not recommended.
Yeah. Well, no, there wasn't zip ties.
Did you say it was more Velcro or?
Yeah, it was one of those like Ergo baby cares. I loved that when my kids were little. But
before the beer's all gone here, talk about what you think, Steve.
It's really good. I'm enjoying it. It's sour, but it's not overly sour. It doesn't want to like strip the enamel off my teeth. It's got that kind of, it's got kind of a saison funk thing going, and yet there's also a very nice sweet component that I taste at the very end. It kind of finishes just with this nice little sweet note that I quite like.
Yeah, it's tart, but not overly sour, I don't think. The beer is kind of golden colored and fairly clear. It's got a nice body to it, which balances the tartness well.
Yeah.
There's a fruity component in there that I can't. And maybe it's because you have a bottle of cherry beer here, I'm thinking of maybe cherries or something like that.
Yeah, and I want to correct myself. Rather than sweet, I think fruity is a better word because it's not sweet, and I don't want people
estery
to think.
Maybe.
Yeah, estery. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Sweet implies something different.
Yeah.
But it doesn't finish like, I don't know, gin. It's not like that. So.
Yeah, it's very good. What's the ABV on this?
Oh, you would ask me.
It's 6.71.
Oh, wow. Look at this label.
Because I read the label.
Oh, look at you.
See, that's why I put that stuff on there. Yeah, so the label says 6.71% ABV. There's a blending calculator by Jeffrey Crane that I used to calculate carbonation on this, which was one thing that really terrified me. I've got these beers that are several years old. It was, I think, about 14 and a half gallons that I blended and bottled. That was if it failed, that would be very painful. So I think I reference with a hyperlink that blending calculator in the post for this beer on my blog. FG after blending was 1.003, pH was 3.71.
Oh.
Not outrageously low.
Right.
And bottled on February 2nd of 2018. So we are tasting it here at 7 months in the bottle.
It's very nice. Has it changed over time?
It's very similar to where it started. I feel like it has gotten a little more sour in the bottle. To me, this isn't outrageously sour.
No.
I mean, they're not outrageously sour, but it's not as sour as what I would expect from pretty much all authentic lambic. You know, they're pretty lemony. And it depends on the year of the blend, but neither of you mentioned how bitter it was or how hoppy it was.
No.
To me, it's a little aggressively hoppy. The aged hops, and maybe it's just because I use them a lot and I'm very familiar with what they contribute, but because this wasn't getting as sour as I expected after, you know, 3 years, 4 years, whatever, I kind of started questioning why is it not getting so sour. So that spawned, as well as some conversations with some professionals like James Howitt from Black Project Spontaneous Ales out in Denver, who I actually saw like a week ago. I had some conversations with him saying essentially, you know, I'm doing pretty much exactly what the Lambic guys said they were doing as far as the process. Why is it coming out so differently? Why is it not getting very sour? And he said, well, your IBUs are probably considerably higher than you are expecting. Shortly after that, Dave Jansen, who has a blog, I'm going to butcher the name. I'm sorry, Dave. It's going to sound dirty. I would pronounce it with my redneck Southwest Missouri slang, Whores Category Brewing. It's H-O-R-S, it's French.
Mm-hmm.
But he published a post that had several data points of lab analysis from authentic lambic, from Cantillon, I don't remember who all else was on there, maybe some Boone and some Driefontein, and so actual measured IBUs on those beers, and the Cantillon was 30 IBUs, whatever year it was that was on there. You know, it listed the year of the goose. It was 30 IBUs, and that was very shocking to people that something that got that sour was 30 IBUs. So some of that data and the conversations I had with James really kind of that led me to kind of develop this experiment that is ongoing right now, where basically it's testing, okay, the way that I'm brewing right now, how many IBUs am I producing? What does that mean? So it's a three-year-long experiment. We're 6 months into the experiment. The experiment starts out with my standard spontaneous brew day, turbid mash. The mash, I did a 24-gallon batch. I've got a system with It's a Herm system, three vessels. They're 34 gallons. So I filled one boil kettle with about 29 gallons of wort. I then split that between, since I've got my hot liquor tank is identical to my boil kettle, except it has the Herm's coil in it. They both have the same 5,500 watt element. So I blended thoroughly, then split the wort, and then did two separate boils simultaneously. One boil kettle received the lowest hopping rate I'd ever used for spontaneous beer, which was 0.3 ounces per gallon of aged hops, which was the lower end of what guys, authentic lambic producers, had reported using. The other kettle got the higher end of what I had used personally, which was 0.6 ounces per gallon. So in a 5-gallon batch, that equates to, on the lower end, it was, I believe, 1.8 ounces in a 5.5-gallon batch. The upper end was 3.2 ounces in a 5.5-gallon batch. So those hops are boiled for three. The boil is an extended boil. It's a three-hour boil. The hops are in there the whole time. I did choose to leave the hops in for the duration of the cool ship. So I've got a stand on wheels at the end of the three-hour boil. Killed the power. Rolled my brew stand out, you know, in my driveway under the big sycamore tree, and I put a data logger running, measuring the temperature of both both kettle ships, we'll call them. They were the boil kettles doing double duty as the cool ship. So log the temperature, because that's another thing that I'm interested in, is what is the cool ship temperature as they cool. Mm-hmm. Homebrew scale is much different than commercial scale, just from the thermal mass of right. what you're working with. So then 12 hours later, so they were cool shipped for 12 hours, there was a sample taken from each one, a wort sample, that was sent to a lab. And they measured the IBUs of each wort at the two different hopping rates. Additionally, prior to brew day, the hops that I used for this batch, he ran alpha and beta tests on the same hops. So on the front end, I knew what the alpha and beta content was per ISBC standards, I believe. And then post, well, just prior to going to the fermenter, I knew the IBU content, essentially. And this is what shocked me. I found this just outrageously shocking. The IBUs, as measured per ISBC standards for the lower hopping rate beer, were 79.1.
What?
I believe it's on the blog post. It's nearly 80 IBUs.
Holy smokes!
And then the higher hopping rate one. Measured 127.1 or 3 something, 127 something IBUs. So to me, that was very shocking.
Yeah.
You know, because this doesn't taste like anywhere near that.
No. No. We're shaking our heads in incredulity.
Yeah, yeah. So neither of you said this is super bitter up front. Now, that was technically a different batch, but it's the exact same process. Thoroughly aged hops at the same rate. It tastes no different to me than this current batch does. So the question is, why is the IBU so high when I'm doing exactly what the masters, you know, are reporting?
And another question is, how are the, because, you know, I read Fal Allen's Goza book, you know, and he talked about some of the lactobacillus or lactic acid producing bacteria are very sensitive to hop bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he's recommending, you know, for a Goza, if you're going to do your souring in the fermenter, to keep it, you know, like maybe lower than 5 IBUs in the mm-hmm. in the beer. So it's just crazy to me that any sourness happened whatsoever in a beer with those numbers of IBUs.
Right. That's, yeah, it's pretty shocking. So I've done a little research. I'm still this kind of casual scientist. I'm not a chemist. There's a lot of guys on like Milk Defunct that are legitimate chemists, and I'm trying to understand, you know, really what's happening. And there's some pretty good references in the post that Dave Jansen did on his blog. But basically what I'm at so far is, and had some feedback from guys like James at Black Project, the hop variety could potentially have a significant impact. I try not to speak in, I'm an engineer by trade, so I try not to say anything is ever 100%. So I'll say it may have an impact. The hop variety, I mean, think about the, with fresh hops, the array of flavors you can have, the array of bitterness levels. So when you age them, maybe those oils drastically change. And even though the alpha and beta are extremely low, and like a regular formula or a Tinsmith formula would say you know, this beer is going to be 3 IBUs, maybe the way that the hop oils change really, you know, doesn't produce something with 3 IBUs. Obviously, that's the case. So this experiment, on my blog, it's called the hopping rate, 2017 Cool Ship Experiment hopping rate, I believe. The hop formulas calculated 3 IBUs and 6 IBUs, and we got, you know, nearly 80 and 127. So
that's great. And what were the alpha acids of the hops?
Right. So it was 0.5% alpha and 0.2% beta.
Wow.
So that calculated at the rates that I used to be roughly 3 IBUs and roughly 6 IBUs.
Wow.
It's
crazy.
I'm stumped.
So I believe it's a problem with the way that IBUs are measured. So we've kind of said this isn't outrageously bitter, but it does measure, you know, these they seem like extreme IBU levels.
Oh, yeah.
So is the way that we are measuring the IBU currently accurate in all cases for representing bitterness? It's called the International Bitterness Unit.
Right, right.
So when the hop oils, and there's a standard list of what, humulone and
cohumulone.
Yeah, so yeah. The standard non-oxidized hop oils, when they oxidize, they change somehow. So we can't really, at this point, calculate the measured IBUs with those oxidized oils. They change somehow. The way that the measurement is done, the oxidized hop oils are contributing to IBUs.
So aging the hops might have some. I mean, the reason that the lambic brewers age hops is because they're not interested in the flavor and aroma of the hops. They just want the antibacterial qualities of the hops, right? So.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. You'll hear some guys say slightly differently on either side of that, but yeah, antimicrobial properties. I think there is some flavor component to it. I mean, you taste a fresh goose or lambic, and maybe it's just because I use the hops a lot. I can taste the hops, and I think that's part of it. I think they contribute to the funk of some of those beers. Mm. If you've had a Brett beer that has a substantial amount of hops in it, I think the hops contribute a lot to the funk that the Brett can then generate. But yeah, generally to help control, so this is 100% spontaneous fermentation. There's a lot of potentially gross, nasty stuff that could take off if that wasn't there. So it's to kind of keep at bay some of these other microbes on the front end and let what we would prefer to ferment over the course of a couple of years, let those things kind of be dominant and the weaker organisms not. I think there's a flavor component for myself, though, especially in this beer. This beer is pretty strongly aged hop forward, in my opinion.
Well, our palates are not trained to recognize those compounds, maybe, Steve. But do you remember, I mean, just a few years ago, it was common knowledge that you couldn't successfully do spontaneously fermented beer outside of the lambic region. You know, it was just like you can't do it outside of Belgium. You know, our bugs don't do it well. But then a few years ago, a homebrewer, and I'm not remembering his name, unfortunately, but a homebrewer sent us a couple of spontaneously fermented beers that he made, you know, on his back porch or whatever, inoculated on his, and they were delicious. They were really good. This one is also delicious. So, to me, it's exciting that Lost 40 is also doing work down in Little Rock with yeast that they've collected.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's yet another area of making, you know, delicious beers. Should we open another beer while we're talking?
Yeah, let's.
What do we got here?
So I called this beer Flemish Incarnation. Incarnation is the name that I use for my red. And Flemish Incarnation because this is a blend of my red sour, which is in my Solera program, and then it is blended with a basically the same grain bill, but cleanly fermented, not a sour beer. So it's kind of an ode to what Rodenbach does. They take their old sour beer and blend it with their younger, not sour beer for the standard Rodenbach, I believe. The Rodenbach Grand Cru, I believe, is not blended with the younger, sweeter beer. So this is kind of an ode to the... I was trying to get something that was a little sweeter. I don't think it's outrageously sweet. It's pretty dry. But it was a blend of a sour beer and a not sour beer of the same grain bill, essentially.
Wow. I've got to say, that's delicious. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like an ode to Billy Joe. It's so good.
It's an ode brewing.
Yeah, no kidding. That's a very nice beer. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is a darker beer. It's more of a dark copper color.
Yep.
I get more oak in this one.
Thank you.
Yeah. And at the end, even there's a little bit of like a dark fruit component as well, kind of a molasses-y component blending in there as well.
Yeah, I definitely get some molasses, get the oak, even a little cherry, maybe just a touch of black pepper. Mm-hmm. It's just a very complex and yet very drinkable beer. You could pound these back, I'm telling you.
And it's a little more tart than the first one, and it's more dry than the first one.
Yeah.
But still very drinkable and not out of balance.
Well, that molasses component at the end just kind of pops the flavor a lot. I really, like the very first sip of this, I was just kind of blown away. It's a great beer.
Yeah, and the oak is really nice in there. It's, you know, it's like not hitting you over the head with the table leg oak. It's just a nice accent. It's very well done, very well blended, and very approachable in my opinion.
It reminds me a little bit of I'm having a senior moment.
It's been a long day for Steve.
It's been a long day. The New Belgium Lafolie.
Oh yeah,
it reminds me quite a bit of Lafolie.
Yeah,
though different. It's definitely not a clone. It's not supposed to be Lafolie, but. As I sip on it, it's reminiscent. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, Lafolie has more of a sauerkraut aroma than this. I don't get
definitely.
Sauerkraut on this one at all.
No.
So
you get sauerkraut on a Reuben.
That's
so you
right.
know.
That's right. I get mine on the side.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Yeah. Thank you. I tend to like oak a lot in sours. A lot of guys don't want it at all. They want neutral barrels or. You know, no oak flavor. I've seen, you know, quite a few conversations on Milk the Funk where they're just poo-pooing at the oak. I absolutely love it. I've done, you know, a carboy with no oak in it, side by side with one that had oak, and I just feel like, I don't know, for me, the oak, I prefer it in what I'm making. And the first Solera that I started with cubes that I bought and gave to my friend, or maybe he just gave them to me. He made some Chamberson wine, and then I got the cubes from him, the medium toast French oak cubes, and that was my first one.
Nice.
So that one still, that carboy still has a very prominent wine character.
Ooh.
Just from that, whatever, 2 ounces of used cubes that had made wine previously. So would you like the recipe for this or just
sure.
ballpark? This is pretty similar to Rare Barrels Red recipe. It is, and this is for what would be my double batch, so that's 11 gallons approximately. So it's 14 pounds of Belgian Pilsen, 3 pounds of Golden Naked Oats, 3 pounds of Weyermann Wheat Malt, 2.5 pounds of Special B, really trying to encourage the sweetness.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe that's where the molasses stuff is coming from.
Yeah.
And 1 pound of aromatic. And that's where my recipe was as of like February 2017. I've been slowly just tweaking, you know, each one as I brew them year after year and blend them back in and kind of see how, you know, some of them get overly sour. I kind of shoot for balance. That's why... I mentioned previously about the fruit. When I've been adding fruit, and they just, I mean, they start out pretty sour, and then you add the fruit, and it's a little too much for me sometimes. Mm-hmm. So this one, it looks like last time I use strictly aged hops, 1 ounce per 5.5-gallon batch, which coincidentally, based on the IBU experiment I just did, is basically what I'm going to start doing this next time for my spontaneous beer. So if at 1.8 ounces I was getting 70-whatever IBUs, theoretically, cut that in half to 0.9, I should get, you know, roughly 35-ish. And that was fresh wort. So that's another thing that my spontaneous beer experiment is tracking, is how are the IBUs changing over time. So we have the first data point prior to any fermentation. Then at 1 year, we're going to check it again. At 2 years, we're going to check it again. At 3 years, at the end of the experiment, we're going to check it again and see how those IBUs change, if they do.
Well, we'll have to follow along with you on your blog. But that's a nice introduction to the – and it's like, wow, just startling. And I'm sure that there'll be lots of questions for you. And I'm sure there'll be lots of skeptics out there, but, you know, well, of course he didn't, you know, he did the measurements wrong, or, you know, there's something, you know, we've done some experiments on this show where people are like, oh, it had to be wrong. But that's all part of the discussion.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about, I coordinated with Jim Gowenis from Sweetwater Science Labs there, local to Missouri. I met him at, it's actually the conference of the shirt I'm wearing, Southeast Craft Beer Craft Beer Fest. They had a little mini conference last year, and I met him there, and we kind of collaborated on doing this experiment together, so he helped me get these IBU measurements for this blog post. And the nice thing about the way I've never done a lab analysis before, maybe everybody does this, but they had three different baseline beers that they also measured at the same time. So they have one, they're probably set for the ISBC standard. So they said, this is an 85 IBU beer, and we actually measured 84.4 IBUs. Okay. So they prove that their measurements are working correctly.
Okay, so they did some benchmarking with known quantities.
Yeah.
So very interesting.
I had the same thing. I was like, oh, maybe.
That can't be right.
Yeah.
Now, in your experience with spontaneous fermentation, and I guess, you know, every time I say spontaneous fermentation, I have to qualify it by, you know, do you remember the theory of spontaneous generation, where it's like if you set rotten meat out, maggots spontaneously appear on the meat, you know, or if you this was an actual scientific before science.
Well, I know.
It's not been around, but you're frowning at me.
Well, I've grown goats that way. I grow a whole bunch of goats out in my pasture. I don't know what you're talking about.
With you just put food in your pantry, and you get mice spontaneously
That's
generated.
Right. They just show up.
But it's not spontaneous. The fermentation comes from bugs, you know, microorganisms that are in the air that fall into the wort. So it's not really spontaneous.
Right.
But these are bugs that you, critters that come out of the sky there in Missouri and make delicious beer.
So, unless I missed this, how do you inoculate the beer?
So and you brought up a good point, spontaneous is a term that is, it's verbatim doesn't mean what it, you know, you look up Webster's, it's not it's more, for me, in my opinion, descriptive of the process of how the authentic lambic brewers are doing it. Mm-hmm. So they're not pitching any yeast at any point intentionally. Maybe throughout their process, if they don't clean well enough, but most of them have, you know, a pretty rigid cleaning schedule. Cantillon has this crazy contraption where they fill their used barrels with, I believe, hot water and these chains, and it just tumbles and just basically, through mechanical action and heat, cleans the barrel. But all the inoculation is supposed to come during the cool ship. There could be some residual stuff in the wood. But for me, when I'm doing spontaneous fermentation, I'm not pitching any yeast. I'm not putting anything in there that I think is going to have yeast and add to it. I'm not having, like, used wood.
There's not a magic stick that you stir the... when we stir with this stick, it makes good beer.
Right. That is it's a problem with terminology. I think there's a lot of terminology issues with farmhouse, saison, sow. You know, it's a huge gamut, and they're not really extremely well-defined to the consumer. That's my real concern, is the consumer side of it. You know, if I buy something that says sour on it, I have an expectation, and if it's grossly different, I'm sometimes a little disappointed. So are you familiar with the Méthode Traditionnelle mark? I believe it. So James from...
Of course I am, but for those who aren't.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you guys had heard of it yet. I believe it was officially announced last year, possibly late the year before.
Oh, that mark. I thought you were talking about the other mark.
No. But Levi Funk from Funk Factory, James from Black Project, and... who's the brewer from Jester King? His name escapes me at the moment. They were kind of the three Americans that kind of spearheaded, to my knowledge, this pursuit of developing a mark that you can use outside of the Sen Valley region, use it to describe your beer if you are producing a beer that is basically lambic, but outside of that region where the appellation is...
Right.
I mean, it's a legal term.
It's
over there.
Sparkling wine to champagne.
Sure. So they tried to develop this mark that brewers can use to let the consumer know essentially how it was produced, and that when they say spontaneous and it has this mark on there, you know, if you know what the mark is, it's a pretty descriptive list of how you are allowed to make the beer, what the recipe can look like. So it really defines the process, the recipe. But it's basically, you know, if a lambic brewer were to write down a recipe and a process, it's pretty much, you know, exactly. And it even specifies the IBUs. So the IBUs of the finished beer, I believe, I don't remember the exact range off the top of my head. It's like up to 35, I believe, in the finished beer. So, those three American guys got that started, and I've seen it on some beers. The Spawn beers from Jester King have it. I believe James puts it on some of his beers at Black Project now. But there's been some controversy about that because they were trying to be respectful to the guys that, you know, basically own the appellation, and, you know, grandpa have been doing it for so long. They wanted to be respectful while identifying their beer as unique in a market that is flooded with disrespect to kettle sours, but if they both say sour on them and they're grossly different, it's confusing to the consumer. So it's an extra little mark that helps the beer that was significantly harder to produce. It helps that kind of, you know, identify itself uniquely.
Cool. Shall we start on the third one?
Sure.
So what do we got here?
So this is, again, my sour red Solera beer, Incarnation. And it was actually the exact same blend of the sour beer that we just had in the Flemish Incarnation. But instead of getting blended with a clean red beer, this just went on to 2 pounds per gallon of Bing cherries, which I picked up very reasonably at Soulard Market in St. Louis.
Ooh.
So... And if I remember correctly, I don't know if I said anything on the label. Well, I'll let you guys try it before I say anything.
Oh. This is, I'm hit not with, there is cherry, but I'm hit, that first sip was spice. Like, maybe cinnamon or what? What is that? Or it's not nutmeg, but there's. It reminds me. It tastes kind of like cookies.
No cookies in it.
Am I crazy or is that just?
That's the new trend. Is Oreo sour beer?
Mm. Oh no!
My favorite band's Oreo Speedwagon. I kind of agree. I mean, maybe you put the thought in my head, but. cookie-like, spice-like, ginger snap-like. I do get cherry. I definitely get cherry.
Yeah.
The nose is really funky. I mean, it's just like, you know, for me, it's just like I've just got through milking the cows, cleaning up the barn. Yeah, I mean, but it doesn't relate to that in the palate. And it's quite nice. I get quite a bit of sour out of it. I think it's quite sour. Mm-hmm. Again, not objectionably so. And what else can I say about it? It's just a nice drinking sour beer.
Yeah, maybe my nose is running right now for some reason, but it's changed. It's the weather. But I don't get a lot of funk in the nose myself, but that could just be my nose.
Yeah. Well, he's also drinking the turds from the bottom of the bottle.
So. Well, that's right.
He gave himself the cookie. Yeah. You did give yourself the cookie.
I did. I was like, well, I'm
talking about describing cookies. You're drinking it.
I've got several friends that just love the dregs. And
Steve's drinking the worm.
Yeah.
In the tequila bottle.
Yep.
Boy, again, a delicious beer. I like all three. It's hard to pick a favorite of these three.
I'm going to hold off for a moment. I think the middle beer is my favorite, but this one's very nice, too. They're all three are, I agree, but I really like the number two and number three quite well.
This one is the most complex to me. There's a lot more going on. You get the cherry. You still got the oak in there as well. You've got this new spice that I can't identify. I'm going to say cinnamon just because that's what I'd say. But very nice again, and very, very drinkable as well.
Thank you. So I hesitated to say, but you guys didn't say it anyways. One thing that I like to do is if something goes a little too sour, I like to add some pure vanilla extract.
Oh.
So this has...
Maybe that's the cookie thing.
So it was a 5-gallon bottling, essentially. It got 50 milliliters of pure vanilla extract.
I bet that's what I'm tasting, because it hit me as cookie.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that.
I've just wanted your affirmation of my comment.
That's right. No, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a cool trick.
Yeah, I'm sure I learned it from somebody else. You know, I don't know where, but I did a presentation at the Homebrew Club meeting last month. Shout out Joplin Homebrew Club, where we called it a blending experiment, but it was we had, you know, multiple different beers, like a Helles stout here from Ozark, which is a fantastic beer, the cream stout, and then one of my like fruited sours. And a couple other things, but we played with blending them together. And one thing that I forced everybody to do was we had little pipettes, 10-mil pipettes. So we were creating little 10-mil blends of the different things to see how the different flavors work together in a blend. The clean malty beer, the other one was Sierra Nevada Torpedo, the outrageously hoppy beer, the roasty beer, and then the sour beer. So how do those flavor components work together? And the last thing I showed them was we had vanilla extract and how, so we did I made them take 10 milliliters of my sour beer, which was more sour than either these two, and then one drop of the vanilla extract, and then to see how it changes your perception of the sourness. That little bit of vanilla gives you a perception of sweetness that helps balance a little more where I like it to be a little more balanced, not so just aggressively my teeth are melting sour, which I don't find pleasant. These are kind of borderline for me. I'd like them to be a little more malty and sweet. That's what I'm working on getting towards, but definitely the vanilla is an excellent trick. You can do with any beer post fermentation. You can take anything in your refrigerator and make a vanilla anything. Just get some good quality vanilla extract, little pipettes off Amazon or wherever. 1 milliliter, 2 milliliters, you know, just kind of play with it. You can, same with cinnamon. I started making my own extracts. I bought a bunch of vanilla beans, Mexican cinnamon, which I believe is Ceylon cinnamon, the artificial, just making my own extracts and then trying them out, you know. I can take anybody's stout and have a vanilla cinnamon stout, any, you know, it's a fun little trick to make the six pack, you know, have a little more variety if you choose. Or your keg, if you've got a keg and you don't want you know, 50 pours of just, you know, whatever brown ale. You can on the back end, you know, kind of give yourself some variety.
Yeah, it sounds fun.
Yeah, it didn't.
So, well, just Sean Paxton was doing that, the homebrew chef. He was doing some of that a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also I wanted to add that the Pipettes were one of my favorite 60s groups.
It's hard to let those go by.
That's right. You got to set them up like that. You got to knock them down.
So, Caleb, what are you doing with all this knowledge? What are you working towards?
Well, the idea is eventually to open a brewery. I'm not yet to the point where I feel like a brewery is a good idea. as mostly speaking towards my children, I've had some things occur recently in my life that led me to feel like fatherhood was vitally important. So I'm kind of holding off the brewery stuff until I feel like I'm confident that you know, my kids aren't going to kill each other or my wife. So
yeah, it's I have a feeling that Steve can attest, when you open your own business, it takes over your life. And so, yeah, if you've got little kids, now's the time to be with them and
exactly,
hone
yeah.
your brewing skills at home. And then when you're ready to come out to the world, you'll be even more highly skilled than you already are.
Thank you, yeah.
All right, tell us the blog again.
Yeah, it's archaicpursuit.com. It's a new blog I started, I believe, in March. It's, you know, mostly experiments that I think might be meaningful to other people. So check it out. Yeah, it's mostly going to be wild, sour, and funky stuff. I do have a table saison experiment on there. But, yeah, just the stuff that inspires me that I'm trying to learn, that's what ends up going on there.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, James.
Well, thanks again to Caleb and to Steve for his hospitality there at Steve's Brew Shop. Caleb's blog, again, is archaicpursuit.com, and I'm looking forward to hearing what else he finds out on his IBU experiments. And Caleb mentioned Dave Jansen a couple of times. You can hear Dave talk about Grisette on the August 18th, 2016 episode of this very podcast. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies always coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can find our logbooks, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. Also, take a look at our silicone pints. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.